Well, it gives me great pleasure to be the first speaker at this year's Mead Symposium. The first one was held actually over 10 years ago in 1992 when Claire Goodrick Clark, Leslie Price, Bob Gilbert and Stephen Ronan all spoke on GRS Mead at Temenos Academy. And the work that has been undertaken since is very interesting in highlighting Mead's importance not only in theosophy as one of the early scholars within the theosophical movement, but his legacy, in fact, to modernity and to other aspects of 20th century culture. And this very much emphasizes the point Colin Price made earlier, that theosophy, of course, has had this seminal and fruitful impact on 20th century culture, and is only now being recognized by actually gathering together this scholarship on these subjects. So my title is From Theosophy to Jungian Psychoanalysis, The Esoteric Harvest of GRS Mead. Mead holds a crucial position in the modern transmission of a Western esoteric tradition. He was a young convert to the new occult movement of theosophy. He served as private secretary to its co-founder, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. He founded the European section of the Theosophical Society, and he edited its London journal, Lucifer, for many years. However, Mead's initial interest in Hinduism and a major involvement with theosophy soon blossomed into a wide-ranging intellectual engagement with the texts of Gnosticism, Neoplatonism, and Hermeticism. His editions and commentaries on these hitherto inaccessible sources of Hellenistic religion and magic became standard works before the First World War, and an important source of inspiration to scholars in comparative religion and also occultists who sought a Western path. When Mead parted company from the Theosophical Society in 1909, for reasons I will describe briefly, he'd already published the majority of his major works on Greco-Egyptian spirituality. These included his books Orpheus, 1896, Fragments of a Faith Forgotten, 1900, his major exegesis of Gnostic remains, a biography of Apollonius of Tyana, a study of the Gospels, and Thrice Greatest Hermes, published in 1906, his monumental three-volume study of a mystical and magical literature associated with Hermes Trismegistus, dating from the first 3 centuries AD. His Echoes of the Gnosis, published as 12 small booklets in 1908, contained such gems as the Hymns of Hermes, the Mysteries of Mithra, and the Chaldean Oracles. These Gnostic fragments were a major source for Carl Gustav Jung, with whom Mead later corresponded and met in London and perhaps in Zurich. Jung was convinced that these archaic religious myths informed the lower levels of his patients' unconscious ancestral memory. So the span of Mead's life and his collaborators stretches from Blavatsky to Jung, a testimony to theosophy's legacy to the 20th century. George Robert Stowe Mead was born in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, in England, on the 22nd of March, 1863. He was the son of Colonel Robert Mead, an officer in Her Majesty's Ordnance, the British Army, and his wife Mary. Mead received a traditional middle-class education, attending Rochester Cathedral School, a respectable public school in Kent. He showed academic promise and proceeded to St. John's College and the University of Cambridge, where he initially read mathematics. However, he soon switched to classics, which gave him an excellent knowledge of Greek and Latin, which would be essential for his lifelong studies. He took his BA degree in 1884, went down from the university, and shortly afterwards joined the Theosophical Society in London. In the same year, he began earning his living as a master at his public school. While already at Cambridge University, Mead had read Alfred Percy Sinnett's Esoteric Buddhism, published in 1883, one of the first comprehensive accounts of theosophy in its Eastern formulation. Fascinated, Mead then made contact with Bertram Cately and Mohini Chatterjee, two theosophists in London, which led to his joining the society. He developed an intense interest in Hinduism and briefly enrolled as an external student of Oriental philosophy at Oxford University. He was also interested in spiritualism at the time, and this led him to study for 6 months in 1887-88 at Clermont-Ferrand University in France, where he made the acquaintance, incidentally, of the young Henri Bergson, later renowned for his philosophy of vitalism. Mead's interest in theosophy was paramount, and after Helena Blavatsky returned from India via continental Europe to settle in London in May 1887, Mead was one of her regular visitors during his school holidays, firstly at Mabel Collins' house in Upper Norwood, and then 17 Lansdowne Road, Bayswater. In 1889, Mead decided to give up teaching in order to become Blavatsky's private secretary, a position he held until her death in May 1891. In addition to handling all Blavatsky's correspondence and working daily with her on her books and articles, Mead soon assumed further organisational responsibilities. In 1889, he was appointed, together with Bertram Catley, joint secretary of the esoteric section of the Theosophical Society, which had been founded in 1888 by Blavatsky for more advanced students. Under Blavatsky's direction, the inner group for selected ES members was founded in August 1890 with Annie Besant and Mead as its secretaries. Already famous for her progressive causes, Annie Besant had joined the society in May 1889 and rapidly became Blavatsky's closest pupil. Here, at her home, 19 Avenue Road, St. John's Wood, the elite group of a dozen disciples or so received Blavatsky's 6 esoteric instructions and other materials relating to cosmology and the esoteric constitution of man in 22 meetings up until April 1891, shortly before her death. As we know, members of the inner group included Annie Besant, Alice Clever, Isabel Cooper Oakley and her sister Laura M. Cooper, Emily Kislingbury and Countess Constance Wachmeister, H.A.W. Corinne, Archibald Catley, Walter Old, of whom we've already heard from Kim Farnell, E.T. Sturdy, Claude Falls Wright, a young American, Irish theosophist, and G.R.S. Mead. When Blavatsky came down with influenza in April 1891, her health had long been poor owing to Bright's disease. On 8th of May, surrounded by 3 of her pupils, she died. Annie Besant was away on a lecture tour, and the funeral oration at Woking, Surrey, was given by Mead. He said, "It is true that the personality we know as H.P. Blavatsky will be with us no longer, but it is equally true that the grand and noble individuality, the great soul that has taught all of us men and women to live purer and more selfish lives, is still active." That spirit lived with him for the rest of his life. Mead would eventually, in 1899, marry Laura Cooper, a member of the inner group. He recalled years later, "They did not marry merely for personal satisfaction, though their marriage was a perfect one, but to maintain a nucleus in succession to the intimate gatherings at 19 Avenue Road." Mead's remarks suggest that he felt a duty to keep the flame of the old inner group alight during the post-Blavatsky years. Following Blavatsky's death, the Theosophical Society was riven with leadership struggles when Annie Besant, William Quan Judge, and Henry Steele Olcott vied with each other against a background of spurious Mahatma letters of support and mutual accusations of fraud. Moreover, once Annie Besant made her first visit to India in 1893, she became increasingly involved in the Home Rule movement and spent each winter at her new home in Benares, which became the headquarters of the Indian section of the Theosophical Society. But Mead wanted no part in these organisational politics, for his interest lay preeminently in the study of religion as the source of theosophy, or divine wisdom. During the 1890s, he embarked on his chosen career in theosophical scholarship, making a major intellectual contribution to the society. Although absorbed in Hinduism and the esoteric Buddhism theosophy, Mead's interest gravitated noticeably towards the Western sources of esotericism. His early article, published in Lucifer, "The Task of the Theosophical Scholars in the West," showed how the young classics graduate from Cambridge was already mapping out his life's work as editor, translator, and disseminator of late Hellenistic religions. In 1890-91, he published a serial article in Lucifer on the Pistis Sophia, containing the first English translation of this major Gnostic text. Another serial on the figure of Simon Magus followed in 1892, the subject of his first book, published in the same year. Between 1896 and 1898, he supplied extensive surveys to Lucifer on the lives of the Neoplatonists and the Gnostics of the first 2 centuries AD. But alongside Mead's budding interest in Gnosticism and Neoplatonism, he continued to edit theosophical works in the Eastern tradition. Given Annie Besant's increasing Indian involvement, he worked from 1893 onwards as joint editor on Lucifer. He prepared Blavatsky's encyclopedic theosophical glossary for publication in 1892 and new editions of The Key to Theosophy, 5 Years of Theosophy, and A Modern Panarion, which appeared, of course, in 93, 94, and 95. Together with Mrs. Besant, he edited a collection of Blavatsky's miscellaneous papers, which was published as the 3rd volume of The Secret Doctrine in 1897. During the 1890s, he was vice president and later president of the Blavatsky Lodge here in London, and in 1907 he assumed sole editorship of the Theosophical Review, as Lucifer was renamed in 1897. appointed General Secretary of the European Section of the Theosophical Society in July 1890. Mead held this position until his resignation in 1897. In 1907, following the death of Henry Steele Olcott, Mead was offered the presidency of the society. But he turned this down in order to pursue his own studies. It's very interesting to speculate that if Mead had become president of the International Theosophical Society at Adyar in 1907, many other things would and wouldn't have happened. After the 1892 publication of Simon Magus, Mead addressed another subject in the Western Esoteric tradition. He published the select works of Plotinus, which had originally been published by Thomas Taylor. And of course, Thomas Taylor's contribution to the tradition is well known, because his works included the Hymns of Orpheus, Iamblichus's Mysteries of the Egyptians, numerous works of Plato, and his own dissertation on the Eleusinian and Bacchic mysteries. Leading romantic writers such as William Blake, Percy Shelley, William Wordsworth, and W.B. Yeats had all acknowledged their debt to Taylor, and here was Mead, of course, following in their wake, editing Taylor's Plotinus. Blavatsky herself had made extensive use of Taylor's Eleusinian and Bacchic mysteries in The Isis Unveiled. Mead's new edition of the leading Neoplatonist Plotinus was followed 2 years later by his long serial article on the philosophical life of Alexandria in Hellenistic times, and the lives and teachings of major Neoplatonists, including Ammonia Saccas, Plotinus, Porphyry, Iamblichus, and other minor figures such as Sopater, Decius, Sosipater, Maximus, Priscus, and Chrysanthius. Mead then switched back to the Eastern tradition, publishing a very interesting book, The World Mystery, in 1895. From an excerpt, The World Soul, another, The Soul Vestures, trace the descent of the soul through four spheres of existence described in the Dream of Ravan, a Vedantic mystic treatise. Mead found a parallel to the five garments, or koshas, food, life breath, mind, knowledge, and bliss. He deduced a telling comparison with the Western Hermetic tradition, whereby its categories corresponded to the Vedantic theosophy. Thus, body, soma, equals food, spirit, pneuma, equals the subtle elements, soul, psyche, equals the impulsive mind, or manas, reason, logos, equals reason, buddhi, mind, nous, equals supreme being, or self, atman. So already Mead was working on a kind of translation between the the repertoires, the vocabularies of Eastern and Western religion. This exercise in comparative theosophy continued with an analysis of St. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians and the Kabbalistic Zohar. The Vedantic theme was continued in his next study, The Web of Destiny, describing the process of manifestation in Buddhist, Vedic, Hermetic, and Christian accounts of creation. The Eastern theosophical traditions were represented in two further editions of Vedantic philosophy prepared by Mead in the same period. The Dream of Ravan in 1895 is a highly poetic mystery allegory. It had been first published as a series of articles in the Dublin University magazine, 1853-54, by an anonymous editor. Its narrative is based on an episode in the Ramayana, when Mandadori broke down with grief after she heard that there would come a time in the future when she could no longer remain Ravan's wife and would be succeeded by another. The chorus of rishis, in its endeavour to cheer her up, told her of the three gunas, or qualities arriving from prakriti, or nature. These gunas are tamas, darkness or indifference, rajas, passion or desire, and sattva, truth or goodness. She was told that she was the wife of the tamasic nature, and was therefore the complement of a predominant tamas quality in Ravan. But when in future birth he rose to the stage of rajas, he would need as a companion and partner someone who was of a higher quality than tamas to spur him on. Mead considered the unknown author to be a master of Vedantic psychology. The three gunas of tamas, rajas, and sattva had been refracted through the prism of Maya to produce a multitudinous universe. Every soul born into the natural life partakes in greater or lesser degree of these qualities, and man's spiritual evolution depends on his knowing these three states of consciousness, how to use them and how to control them. Mead was clearly fascinated by Oriental philosophy, and his next offering was a compact two-volume edition of the Upanishads, which he published in 1896. He regarded this as a fundamental theosophy of the Vedas, handed down to the Aryan inhabitants of India. Dating from about 500 BC, the Upanishads aimed not so much at systematic philosophy as to the search for truth and to bring peace and freedom to the human spirit. Their essential teaching is that knowledge gives release. They are distinct from the Vedic hymns in their monistic implications and more subjective analysis. And Mead's intention was to provide a fruitful and idiomatic version of the Upanishads, accessible to anyone who could read English. Mead saw the Upanishads as a world scripture which could appeal to the lovers of religion and truth in all races and at all times. Again, he was echoing the theosophical motto, there is no higher religion than truth. Now, I'm going to pass on at some speed now, because what I need to emphasize is really Mead's legacy to modernity. We've already established his close involvement with Gnostic, Neoplatonic, and Hermetic literature, and Claire Goodrich Clark's going to be talking at some length about his work on Gnosticism and Hermeticism, and their anticipation of modern scholarship on this subject this afternoon. So I now want to talk about Mead's legacy. In February 1909, Mead resigned from the TS. The immediate reason for this decisive break lay in the Society's handling of the charges of sexual impropriety levelled against Charles Leadbeater. Leadbeater's success, which was quite extraordinary and meteoric in the 1890s following his involvement with theosophy, was reversed in January 1906 by allegations that he had practiced sexual improprieties under the guise of occult training to the sons of American theosophists. The latter initiated moves to have Leadbeater expelled from the TS, while Annie Besant sought to defend her colleague. The president, Henry Steele Olcott, appointed a committee in London in May to advise him, and Mead was a member of that committee. And the minutes recorded strong disapproval of Leadbeater's self-justification and evasions. Mead was involved in all sorts of politics at the time, in the first decade of the 20th century. He and Annie Besant, for instance, entertained Rudolf Steiner here in London and so on. So Mead was very much au fait with all the figures of the international theosophical movement at the time. But this crisis with Leadbeater seemed to basically be something that finally broke. Mead was a member of this committee, and the minutes recorded strong disapproval of Leadbeater's evasions. Leadbeater's resignation was accepted, and his special appointment as a presidential delegate was cancelled. Eventually, Mead and some 700 members of a British section resigned from the society in protest at Leadbeater's reinstatement. While repelled by Leadbeater's conduct, Mead felt the case highlighted a more fundamental flaw in the mission and constitution of the society. Mead particularly objected to the invocation of the Mahatma's authority concerning the internal affairs and governance of the society. Mead prized theosophy as a quest for divine wisdom and a love of truth with the aids of study, reason, and gnosis. And he couldn't reconcile this search for divine wisdom with blind obedience to dogmas and directives. He wrote, "I'd never preached the Mahatma gospel of Blavatsky or propagandized neo-theosophy," by which he means the clairvoyance and other practices of Besant and Leadbeater. "I had believed that theosophy proper meant the wisdom element in the great religions and philosophies of the world." Mead's tireless editing, his prolific output of articles for Lucifer and the Theosophical Review, and his extensive books were all devoted to that end. Mead's break with the society was a major event in his life. As a member of 25 years standing, editor of the Theosophical Review, and holder of numerous public offices, the Theosophical Society had effectively offered him a continuous career as editor, scholar, and writer. However, like many other older members, even those who left, he retained a lifelong respect for an affection for Blavatsky. With her magnetic personality, she had opened up to him a world of spiritual inquiry. As her private secretary, he saw all her correspondence, and he regarded her as such a frank and careless character that she could scarcely have hidden any forgery or trickery in her past. He knew that she was no scholar, but he marveled at her unknown sources of secret scripture. Though no Mahatma disciple himself, Mead never doubted Blavatsky's sincere belief in the Mahatmas or her mission. Because through Blavatsky, Mead had discovered and entered a world of theosophical sacred literature. The Society's journal and publishing house had supported his work of exploring this world for some two decades. Mead related to the world of Gnostic, Neoplatonic texts, Hindu and Buddhist scriptures in Blavatsky's Isis Unveiled and The Secret Doctrine. He could not relate to the clairvoyant researches and neo-theosophy of Besant and Leadbeater. And in this sense, Mead remained loyal to the Blavatskyan theosophy as an adventure into the ancient wisdom tradition. The Quest Society was in fact Mead's next experiment. Mead had no intention of leading a dissident theosophical society composed of the 700 or so defectors who resigned with him over the Leadbeater affair, nor was he their leader. But by 1909, the neo-theosophy of Besant and Leadbeater had long since been the dominant current in the society, with which most members were familiar, even if they now reviled Leadbeater's conduct. Instead, Mead resolved to found a new society consonant with his own studies and deepest spiritual interests. He intended this association to be genuinely undogmatic, unpretentious, claiming no pseudo-revelations, and truly honest inside and out. Supported by 150 of the Society's dissidents and some 100 new members, the Quest Society was founded in March 1909 with two objects. Firstly, to promote investigation and comparative study of religion, philosophy, and science, almost an identical object to the TS, on the basis of experience. And secondly, interestingly enough, to encourage the expression of the ideal in beautiful forms. Mead's commentary on these objects is highly revealing concerning his own spiritual convictions. The Quest Society initially had no premises, but organised a termly programme of public lectures in Kensington Town Hall in central London. Its chief activity consisted in the publication of The Quest, which ran from 1909 to 1931, whose contributors and their articles record Mead's commitment to its declared objects throughout two decades of tireless editing and writing. The Reverend J. Estlin Carpenter, principal of Manchester College, Oxford, and author of studies on Palestine and the Gospels, wrote on Japanese Buddhism. Caroline Rhys-Davies, a lecturer at SOAS, School of Oriental and African Studies, wrote articles based on her own books on Buddhism. The Reverend Hugh John Dokenfelder Astley, Vice President of the British Archaeological Association, wrote about animism and anthropology in the Old Testament. Frederick Conybeare, Fellow of University College Oxford and author of studies on Aristotle, Philo and the Paulician Church of Armenia, contributed on the religion of Mani and on Apollonius of Tyana. Rudolf Karl Bultmann, the young professor of New Testament at Marburg and a trenchant opponent of liberal theology, contributed some of his early work on the Fourth Gospel. And the controversial Austrian writer of The Jesus Messiah, Robert Eisler, contributed regularly on biblical subjects. Sir William Fletcher Barrett, professor of physics at the Royal College of Science Dublin and founder of the SPR, wrote about creative thought and the spiritual significance of nature. And the eminent vitalist philosopher, follower of Bergson, Hans Driesch, contributed his thoughts on modern psychology. Besides these names from academe and the church, Mead was also successful in attracting literary and artistic figures to lecture and write for the magazine. Ezra Pound, the young American poet, sought out Mead in September 1911. Pound enjoyed discussions with Mead and gave a lecture in 1912 to the Society on pagan elements in the literature of the medieval troubadours of Provence, based on his own researches into the Cathars and the Languedoc. Arthur Edward Waite, England's leading authority on occult and alchemical subjects, and Jesse L. Weston, a noted writer on the Arthurian romances, both wrote articles on the Holy Grail. Sir John Woodruff, an expert on tantricism and kundalini yoga, wrote on Shakti. Of course, he's better known as Arthur Avalon, the serpent of power. Gustav Meyrink, the Austrian author of Der Golem, and member of many esoteric societies, wrote on Buddha and contributed tales of the occult. Arthur Machen, a former member of the Golden Dawn and noted writer of supernatural stories, supplied a piece on the secret language. Algernon Blackwood, another successful author of mystery stories and a Golden Dawn veteran, supplied short stories about remote viewing and the exiled gods. Rabindranath Tagore supplied short stories, poetry, aphorisms, the sayings of Dadu, and a piece on the appeal of Christ to India. Evelyn Underhill wrote numerous articles on mysticism, dynamic love, and magic. In 1916, Baron Friedrich von Hügel wrote on the German soul and the Great War. And the eminent art historian and follower of René Guénon's traditionalism, Anand Kumarasamy, wrote on the Hindu view of art. Aethel Cohoon, a young surrealist artist better known for her studies of the Golden Dawn in later age, wrote on the prose of alchemy. Mead's work on Gnosticism and the Quest attracted an influential literary following in pre-war London. there were many others surrounding the Pounds and Dorothy Shakespeare after they were married, and Pound was very enthusiastic about Mead. Certainly by 1912, Pound was lecturing to the Quest Society, and Dorothy, his wife, were eagerly reading Mead's Fragments of a Faith Forgotten. The letters exchanged daily, almost, between Dorothy and Ezra in 1912 make frequent references to their enthusiasm for Mead's work, and indeed for the Meads themselves. Witness Dorothy's letter to Ezra in June 1912. "The Meads here at tea yesterday, they both have so much, and such a pleasant personality." The Quest was published by John Watkins, London's leading esoteric bookseller at 21 Cecil Court, Charing Cross Road, where his bookshop still stands, and carried advertisements for sympathetic periodicals and groups, including the Asiatic Review, The Seeker, a magazine for Christian mysticism, which of course regularly published articles by Isabel de Steiger and others within the TS, and the Alchemical Society, founded in 1912, for the professional study of the scientific and philosophical and historical study of the alchemists. Mead himself contributed an article to every issue of the magazine. He continued to pursue his established interest in Hellenistic religion with studies of the subtle body in the West, Zoroastrianism, and articles on early Christendom. A series of pieces on ceremonial games, dances, and banquets in medieval churches was also published in the Quarterly. The Far East also engaged his interest, witnessed by papers on Taoism and Buddhism. With the advent of the Great War in 1914, the horizon darkened, and his contributions addressed the religious significance of the war and its trials. And after the armistice, of course Mead wasn't young enough for active service, Mead wrote on regeneration and reconstruction from a spiritual point of view. He still wrote widely on Gnosticism with articles on Mandean scripture, Gnostic John the Baptist. The end of the war and its shortages enabled the magazine to resume regular quarterly publication. Premises were also found for the Quest Society at 27 Clareville Grove, SW7, which provided a library for some 4,000 volumes and a lecture room. Mead presided as president with C.C. McCrae, Mrs. William Sharp, the widow of the Scottish poet who went by the name of Fiona MacLeod, and A.E. Waite as vice presidents. Meetings for lectures were held once a fortnight with a break of 3 months in the summer. Laura Mead, his beloved lifelong companion in theosophy since their early days together in the inner group, assisted Mead in the secretarial work of the society until her death in 1924, and following her death, Mead engaged in spiritualistic seances and was convinced of survival after death. Mead continued to publish The Quest until 1930. It was ruined effectively by the crash on Wall Street, when it was impossible, in fact, to continue such ventures with an overall depression spreading across Europe. The life of the Quest Society extended over two decades, only 5 years less than his lifelong involvement, his long involvement with the TS itself. His own society reflected not only his own interests in comparative religion, psychical research and philosophy, but what he thought the Theosophical Society could and should have become. Shortly after his departure in 1909, Charles Leadbeater had discovered the young Jiddu Krishnamurti in Adyar, an exceptional youth whom he and Annie Besant subsequently proclaimed the young world or coming Messiah. Annie Besant's major involvement with the Indian National Congress and the apocalyptic expectations surrounding Krishnamurti until his own renunciation of that role in 1929 had left the Theosophical Society on paths far afield from Mead's time. In his dedication to the study of esotericism and comparative religion, Mead remained true to his own original glimpsed as a young man editing Blavatsky's works and outlined in that programmatic paper the task of Theosophical Scholars in the West way back in 1891, before her death. The Quest Society and its quarterly have also been seen as a major forerunner in the development of comparative religion as a scholarly subject, and also as a forerunner of the renowned Eranos conferences convened annually since 1933 by Olga Forever-Capitain at her villa on the northern shore of Lago Maggiore near Ascona. Her original conception of a roundtable discussion of Western and Eastern traditions in religion, mythology, philosophy and science had flowered over successive decades with the participation of such luminaries as Carl Gustav Jung, Martin Buber, Karl Kerenyi, Henri Corbin, Mircea Eliade, Gershom Scholem and Gilles Kispel, all leading scholars in religion. Frau Froebel had run earlier summer schools to which she invited the theosophists Alice A. Bailey, Violent Tweedale and Robert Assagioli, who would later achieve prominence as the founder of psychosynthesis. She included Jung and Mead in her early invitations to the summer school. Although Mead did not, in the event, participate in the Uranus conferences, it was only 2 years before his death, and he was already quite infirm. Both Robert Eisler and Carolyn Rhys Davis, leading scholarly contributors to the quest, were regular presenters at Uranus. Robert Eisler, 1882 to 1949, a native of Vienna who taught at the Sorbonne and as an émigré from 1940 at Oxford University, wrote pioneering studies of the fourth gospel, the Messiah Jesus, and John the Baptist, and comparative studies of Orphic and early Christian cult symbolism. His path-breaking discovery of Passover symbolism was confirmed by scholars only in the mid-1960s. And his early contributions to Mead's journal, both prior to 1914 and during the 1920s, demonstrate continuity with his 1935 lecture at Uranus. It also demonstrates the forward thinking of Mead in attracting such promising young scholars to his circle almost a quarter of a century before their recognition. Carolyn Rhys Davis presented regularly on Indian religion at the first four Uranus conferences from 1933 to 1937. And Carl Gustav Jung, an enthusiastic admirer of Mead's work on the Gnostics, became a leading participant at Uranus from its inception until his death in 1961. Well, I want to talk now about the Gnostic revival and C.J. Jung and show the ways in which Mead's work on Gnosticism had this direct impact on Jung's thought. Mead's exploration of the Hellenistic mystery religions, though scholarly, was also an inspired quest for personal Gnosis. In his painstaking editions, commentaries, and translations of ancient texts, Mead sought the energizing of theosophy or divine wisdom within himself. Whatever released man from his little self and refunded him into his greater self, even momentarily, Mead regarded as a divine impulse. Invoking spiritual hierarchies, Mead imagined this as a work of winged intelligences who speak the universal language of the soul. And Mead's extensive work on Gnosticism was an important influence on Jung as he developed the fundamental ideas of psychoanalysis and depth psychology. Jung is today renowned as the founder of an international school of psychoanalysis, which is distinct from that of Freud. It places man's spiritual development at the heart of analytical psychology. Jung's ideas of a collective unconscious and archetypes are complemented by his theories of individuation as a form of rebirth through the analysis of dreams and memories and other manifestations of the unconscious. Jung had already made important progress in developing these ideas prior to the First World War as a result of several major interests. One of these was spiritualism. As a young medical student, Jung was drawn to spiritualism and experimented in seances from 1895 to 1900 with his mediumistic cousin, Helene Preisberg. Jung based his doctoral thesis on his notes from these sittings, where spirit personalities, including dead ancestors of the Jung family, spoke through the girl. Jung's profound interest in these extraordinary states of consciousness also introduced him to transpersonal entities. And by 1905, Jung had encountered the psychoanalysis of Sigmund Freud, with whom he collaborated closely from 1905 to 1912. Jung was firstly attracted to Freud's idea that analysis could offer a talking cure for repression of trauma and unconscious memories. Freudian psychoanalysis stressed themes of bond-breaking, irrationality, and sexuality, with the implications of revitalization, an idea widely current at the Fin des Siècles, deriving from such philosophers as Friedrich Nietzsche and philosophy of life. But during his studies, Jung was also studying the works of Ernst Haeckel, a professor of zoology at Jena and the leading authority on evolutionary biology in Germany. Haeckel advanced a theory that the stages of individual development, ontogeny, recapitulated the states of the embryo of the human race, phylogeny. This led Jung around 1909 to postulate a phylogeny of the soul, and in his major work, The Psychology of the Unconscious, 1911, Jung claimed that the soul possesses historical strata, the oldest corresponding to the unconscious. A good example of how Jung imagined this comes out in the following anecdote. On his journey to America with Freud to drum up more patients, particularly among the wealthy community of New York, Jung had had a dream in which he explored the lower floors and subterranean levels of an old house. This suggested to him that he should mine the unconscious contents of the mind. On his return home in September 1909, Jung began to immerse himself in archaeology and mythology. In particular, he was interested in the myths and rituals of ancient Hellenistic mystery religions. according to his phylogeny of the soul, such early religions and mythologies would correspond to the lower unconscious strata of the mind of contemporary individuals. The writings of Friedrich Kreutzer, who lived in the 18th and early 19th century, a professor of philology and ancient history at Heidelberg, were a major source of information on the Greco-Roman mystery cults, and this led him to the Gnostics. Jung pored over Kreutzer's four-volume Symbolik und Mythologie der alten Völker, besonders der Griechen. It was published between 1810 and 1812, and it was a very antique text. But Jung also used the works of Mead. He was fascinated by the idea that there could be, in fact, a recognition of such figures from ancient mythology in the fantasies or visions of patients. Jung was convinced, for instance, that the solar phallus man, the vision of a psychotic Burghölzli clinic patient circa 1910, corresponded to a figure in the Mithraic liturgy. This correspondence, he believed, offered conclusive evidence for the collective unconscious as a mine, a deep mine, down which one could go to explore ancient religious myths, and these in turn recorded the phylogenetic development of the human soul. Jung's quoted source for the Mithraic liturgy was Mead's translation, the sixth in that rather fine 12-volume series, Echoes of the Gnosis, published between 1906 and 1908. It transpires that Jung was greatly indebted to G.R.S. Mead's copious and fluent editions of Gnostic writings in English. German scholars hitherto had concentrated on very obscure etymological and philological issues in the Gnostic texts. But Jung, who of course could read English fluently as a young and brilliant medical student, found that Mead's translations offered him direct access to the Askew and Bruce codices, which had lain in Latin until 1850, when Mead translated them in the 1890s. The Askew and Bruce codices had remained the province of classical specialists, except for Mead's extensive translations, and Jung's personal library contained some 18 books by Mead. These include Simon Magus, Apollonius of Tyana, Fragments of a Faith Forgotten, Thrice Gratis Hermes, The World Mystery, Some Mystical Adventures, The Doctrine of a Subtle Body in Western Tradition, and others. Besides extensive accounts of the Gnostics by their enemies, Fragments of a Faith Forgotten offered Jung complete English translations of the Askew and Bruce codices, as I've said. Also contemporary with Jung's early studies in mystery cults were his collection of Mead's book series, Echoes of the Gnosis. He owned the Vision of Arideus, the Hymn of Jesus, a Mithraic ritual vital to that discussion of the solar phallus man, vision of the patient, also the Gnostic crucifixion, the Chaldean oracles in two volumes, the Hymn of the Robe of Glory, and the Wedding Song of Wisdom. Following his readings on Hellenistic mystery cults, Jung took a special interest in Gnosticism from 1912 onwards, writing enthusiastically about the Gnostics to Freud in August 1912. Jung regarded the Gnostics not as syncretists who were just mixing up systems and doctrines, but as seers who were bringing forth visions from their own minds, visions that corresponded to fundamental divine wisdom. That, of course, is the link that Mead was making with theosophy all along. This is what Jung now found in his translations of Mead, a direct link back into the human soul and its perception of the divine. In 1916, Jung experienced a series of dramatic and extraordinary visions, which he formulated in his oracular work, Seven Sermons to the Dead, which recounts the apparition of Christian crusaders who failed to find answers to their spiritual quest in Jerusalem. They came to Jung's door in Zurich and asked for what they had not found in Jerusalem. Among his Gnostic themes, Jung's, are nothingness, fullness, pleroma, pairs of opposites, and Abraxas, the Gnostic deity of the Basilidean system, described in detail by Mead. Jung regarded this text with its strange rhetorical register, that's his own work, The Seven Sermons of the Dead, as an intensely personal document, which was not published until after his death. In 1949, one copy had come into the hands of a young Hungarian emigre, Stefan A. Höller, who was sitting in a freezing library in Innsbruck as an emigre on his way from communist Hungary to the West. As a bishop of the Ecclesia Gnostica headquartered in Los Angeles, Höller has written widely on Jung and Gnosticism and fostered the growth of other Gnostic churches. And Heller has also emphasised Mead's crucial role in the modern Gnostic revival and his importance to his own work. Mead's influence on modern Gnosticism goes far further than that on Jung alone. It's proven to be an important link in the transmission of the Western East Terek tradition. Another famous writer who was a great influence in the 1960s, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in Germany in 1962, Hermann Hesse, underwent over 70 sessions with Josef B. Lang, a Swiss disciple of Jung in Zurich. And he also, Hesse, was deeply impressed by Gnostic themes. In his popular novel Demian, first published in 1919, but a bestseller in the 1960s, Hesse introduced Lang as Pistorius, a student of ancient religions, who explains to Demian the Gnostic god Abraxas, who is beyond good and evil, containing within himself the world of light and the world of darkness. Hesse's description of Demian's growth in independence and self-knowledge partially reflect Jung's work on Hellenistic religions and the unconscious. And as I've said, in the 1960s, counterculture, Hesse's novels enjoyed an enormous revival amongst young Americans and Europeans. There was even a best-selling LP of an Afro-Latin rock group called Santana, named after Abraxas. Mead's impact on the modern reception of Gnosticism has continued right up to the present. The New American poets, Robert Duncan, who only died in 1988, and Kenneth Rexroth, have both acknowledged Mead's importance in their own work. Raised in a theosophical family, Duncan, who was born in 1919, was later encouraged by Rexroth to explore many subjects within the Western esoteric tradition. He didn't need much encouragement, because in his short intellectual biography, he traced the influence upon his own family of a modern occult revival, and explained how Blavatsky, Yeats, and the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn had been regular subjects around the dinner table while he was brought up by his foster parents. In his account, he paid fulsome tribute to Mead and the Quest magazine, asserting that his purpose was to, quote, revive the senses of the divine world as the real, the source of man's vital life. As a poet, Duncan never lost sight of that vision. Mead's books were among his favourites, as evidenced by a portrait by the artist Jess, formerly Burgess Collins, who only died last year, showing Duncan standing beside Mead's Pistis Sophia and Thrice Grotius Hermes. It's also true that Mead's influence on Jess, the artist's imaginative world, was perhaps as great as it had been on Duncan. And these figures are, of course, icons of the literary and artistic scene in California and in America. Mead died in London in 1933, only 3 years after he had had to cease publishing The Quest due to the economic crash. His tireless work on the sacred literature of the Hellenistic world and his insistence on its perennial resonance in the human spirit had filled a lifetime's work. Ever since his youthful discovery of the Theosophical Society, he'd employed his gifts as editor, translator, and classical scholar to explore the rich world of Hermetic philosophy and Gnosticism alongside the Eastern traditions of the Upanishads, the Vedanta, and Buddhism. He was one of the first theosophists to articulate a Western theosophy rooted in Orphism and Neoplatonism. C.J. Jung's reception of Gnosticism as a spiritual map of the unconscious, its tributaries in modern society and in modern literature and poetry, the Quest Society's anticipation of East-West dialogues at the Uranus Conference, and its contribution to comparative religion, even down to the local impact on British art, such as Gustav Holst's The Planet, are all attributable to memberships within the Quest Society. They all indicate the seminal influence of Mead, not only within and on modern theosophy, but also modern theosophy's legacy to scholarship, psychology, and the arts. Thank you.